Hey there, this is Kevin from the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, and I have something new for you. We're launching a brand new podcast, and this is it. It's the DIY Musician Stories Podcast, hosted by Monty Carty. This will have a similar indie vibe that you're used to from the DIY Musician Podcast, but it will solely focus on musicians and their stories, stories of struggle and success. And it'll dive into topics more about their music and artistic expression. In order to introduce you to this new podcast, we're putting the first few episodes down the DIY Musician Podcast feed. So that's why you're hearing this right now. So if you're liking this new podcast and what you're hearing, you'll want to be sure to subscribe to this directly. All you have to do is search DIY Musician Stories wherever you listen to podcasts and hit that subscribe button. Don't worry, the DIY Musician Podcast that you've known and loved for years is still going strong, but now you have two podcasts to listen to and enjoy. With all that said, here's the DIY Musician Stories Podcast, hosted by Monty Carty.
Hello, and welcome to the DIY Musician Stories Podcast. I'm Monse, and in this episode, I'm chatting with my friends Ali Russell and JT Nero of Birds of Chicago. They share their origin story, their writing process, and what it's been like to pause and pivot from a life on the road. We also talk about collective grief, the rejection every artist encounters, finding your tribe, and so much more. I hope you enjoy. Well, I'm so interested to talk to you about like what has it been like when you two are on tour all the time, and you were on tour like as the pandemic was all starting to unfold and get worse and worse, and you had your tour with the Wood Brothers that came to a total halt.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if you could talk about what that was like, both on or what it's been like on an emotional level and also just, you know, practical level. Like, how have you been able to pivot?
Right. Right. Well, emotionally, it was intense. I mean, as I think it was for everyone. Like when we, so the tour got shut down, I believe it was March 11th. We flew back home March 12th, and Ida and our sister Anna were actually in Mexico visiting our dear friend Barbara, who, you know, is like kind of Ida's abuela, like a surrogate grandma.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they had gone out there because we were on an extended tour, we thought, with the Wood Brothers. And so then it was, the real fear was, what if we can't get them back as the borders were starting to shut down? And so that was terrifying. But they, so we got home the 12th and they made it back the night of the 13th.
Oh, thank goodness.
And so, and then we just went full quarantine after that for, I don't know, it was over 130 days before we extended the quarantine by one, our bubble by one family where Ida could have a friend.
Right, right.
You know, because she's an only child. So it was just Ida with JT and I, our sister Anna, and our other chosen sister Yola. Yes. So just surrounded by adults. And
yes.
So, I mean,
yes.
Again, we have a home we had friends whose houses were crushed in the tornado, you know, and it's like shelter at home when you don't have a home, you know, so, and all of the people living unhoused, you know, around North America and the world, you know, you think about those things, you think about the people who have food and security,
yeah.
Like we were fine, you know, really we were. It was psychological adjustment was difficult for sure. I mean, for me, I've literally been running most of my life since I was and I haven't really stopped, you know, running away from or running to or just being on the road in pretty much nonstop since I was 15 years old. So this was the first time I'd unpacked my suitcase in years.
That's so interesting when you're like forced to sit still when that's not the rhythm of your being, you know, in your life. And
like,
that's something
you have to. Yeah.
Yes, man. Yeah. I've been thinking about this a lot, just what you said, because I've been feeling pretty low, you know, the last couple months, especially recently. And I don't like to talk about it too much because I feel guilty in a way. Like I have no right to feel so this way when there's so much else out there and so many other people that need to be that are dealing with real hardships. But I have to say that I'm talking about it more now because I realize that everybody's feeling this way, mm-hmm. and it's good to normalize it. And you know, like when I told a couple of friends, I think it was like a week or two ago, that I was just feeling pretty depressed, you know, and they said, me too. And I had no idea, you know?
Yeah.
But I think this is impacting everybody in different ways and different levels. And, you know, even if we're lucky enough to have our health, you know, and have a roof over our heads and all these things, it's just, there's a real psychological sadness, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's grief. I feel like we're all grief. The stages of grief. How could we not? You know, trauma is trauma. Grief is grief. You know, it's like, it really is. This is a massive, massive, unprecedented in our lifetimes shift and world tragedy, you know, unprecedented in our lifetimes. How can we not? And the old normal, you know, is never coming back. Whatever happens next is not going to be the old normal. And it's not that the old normal was perfect, but that's what we knew.
Exactly.
There's just grief to it's loss. It really,
that's right.
Yeah. I also think that it's important not to fall into the trap of the sort of skewed emotional logic of I shouldn't feel depressed because other people have it worse. I think when you do that, that sort of almost makes it a flipped logic situation where everybody is trying to level themselves at the shittiest possible, you know?
Totally, no totally. Faith.
Like the North Star is to get everybody feeling back to what, you know, your sense of good was, not to get everybody to a level of the worst possible way you can feel. So there's nothing wrong, you know, if you have been in a blessed situation to know what good emotional health feels like, you know, combined with relative privilege and all that sort, you know, when the walls cave in on you a bit, don't feel bad. You know, you want to you maintain your awareness that other people have it worse, but don't not feel bad about it because we're still trying to get back to that good place, right?
That's right. That's such a good point. And it's funny how a lot of us, myself included, will extend that kind of empathy and kindness towards others, but not to myself, you know, where I'm like, well, I don't have a right. But then if I see a friend suffering, of course I have the empathy, you know, and I'm not thinking, oh, you don't have a right to be sad, you know?
Right. Everybody has a right to be sad and
that's
everybody
right.
has a right to be happy, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And since they're not conscious decisions, it almost takes the language of right and wrong out of it anyway. You just got to deal, you know, you deal with it.
The truth of our emotions. Yeah.
It's true. And I think there's something like, you know, I always think that, like, you know, in order to really be able to be of service to others and help others, like, you have to kind of be okay in yourself first, you know? And so it's like, you have to sort of nurture your own sadness and feel what you have to feel in order to really show up for people in an authentic, real way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can't more.
And Allie, I've been thinking a lot about you because you have, and we've talked about this before in other interviews, but you've been through such difficulty in your early life, and you really had to build this resilience muscle early on. And I'm wondering, like, how has that helped you at all during times like this? Like, do you feel like, what do you pull on to be able to sort of move through these really challenging situations?
That is an interesting question. I think what I have discovered is that I've been really dependent on constant motion and busyness.
Yes.
In order to manage a lot of the kind of trauma that I still deal with and will deal with for the rest of my life from my childhood. So like you, I mean, the first month of this hit me really hard. I was very low and, you know, sort of checked out emotionally, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started, then the sort of floodgates opened and I think I started allowing myself to just feel grief more. And I started doing a lot of writing, a lot of writing sort of poetry, some of which I'll probably never share, writing songs and kind of throwing myself, writing, I think maybe a memoir. I appear to be deeply going into that as well. Just processing a lot of the kind of, things that I have not completely repressed, but kind of pushed to the back of my mind and ignored in favor of constantly being busy and constantly being on the road, you know, and I can't do that now. So now I actually have to deal with some stuff, you know.
It's so interesting, isn't it? How it's almost, I really, really relate to that because I'm what's really hard for me is I'm always traveling. And I think I use that. We all sort of have our drug of choice, you know, to like kind of numb a lot of the intense feelings we have. And some people it's alcohol, some people it's drugs, some people it's chocolate, it's whatever, you know. But like one of the things for me is the busyness, you know, and keeping myself busy and traveling. And when you're forced to have that come to a halt, just like you said, I realize that that's really, it's like it's forcing me to sit with sadness and the things that are really deep down, you know, in there that I don't want to really look at. So it sounds like that's kind of what's happening to you as well.
Definitely. And I feel like it's happening to our whole world on a like macrocosm.
Yes.
You know, that is what the current, you know, intense struggle for equality and the anti-bigotry movement, you know, that we're, obviously, it comes out of all the violence that is being visited upon Black and Indigenous and other people of color at way higher rates. Obviously, it comes out of that. But, and the, you know, and the catalyst of the horrific video, which I will never watch, of George Floyd's murder. And, you know, it comes out of that. But I don't think any of this, I don't think people think about it to this degree or have it stay with them to this degree if it's not for this enforced time of uncomfortable introspection, you know,
that's right,
and reflection and processing some of what, you know, in the same way that we individually are processing different griefs and traumas and truths that we've kind of pushed to the back of our minds. We're doing that, you know, as a world, as a global human civilization, you know, dealing with the traumas of our history and present, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. It just sort of feels like all this heavy, I mean, I don't know another word to say other, this darkness of a lot of reality is just coming up to the surface right now all at once, you know, and it's just, it's a lot. And just like you said, it's, the word is grief, you know, it's really a collective grief that we're moving through.
Yeah, I think so. And everyone's in different stages of it, which creates conflict. Of course, you know, some people are in utter denial.
Yep.
Some people are in rage. Some people are in acceptance. You know, some people are looking for how to make things better. But it's like we're all in different stages of the
process. That is so true. And even, and it's funny how we can, I'm sure you can, you relate to this as well. It's like we kind of move through it in different, even our, as our individual selves, like from one week to the next, we can feel a bit differently. Like there's days where I feel optimistic and, you know, have a really positive outlook on everything. And I'm like, okay, we're like moving through these things. And then the other days where I just feel utter despair, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that's only human, you know?
Yes. It's
well, we're all processing, right? We're all in it.
Yeah.
Literally in it together.
Exactly. I want to, you know, for people listening that don't know your full story, can you, so Birds of Chicago is sort of like the mothership, and then you have all these other projects as well. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the evolution of how this all came to be and about your little family and, you know, and just sort of the other projects that you have, anything that, you know, people that don't really know the story behind Birds of Chicago would love to hear.
Sure.
Well, I don't think there's very many people left out there that aren't familiar with the legend of Birds of Chicago. But for those people, dusty corners, we'll fill them in. Allie and I have been, I mean, we met around the turn of the century.
That's right. At Folk Alliance Invention.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. See, I'm learning something new.
2001. Can you believe that? In 2001, yeah. At the Folk Alliance in Vancouver, BC. And I was just a child, and I was still in the closet as a musician. I wasn't a child. I was a teenager. But I was still in the closet as a musician.
I was 14, and I was there with a... an Irish step dancing.
No, he wasn't. That's true. I was there as a guest of my friends, the Bigitanias, and I was still in the closet, pretty much as a musician and writer. Like I was singing a little bit, actually, in a Celtic band, a Celtic bar band in Vancouver at that time.
I was not yet
like publicly writing songs.
This has been
you weren't publicly writing songs, so you're writing them and just keeping them to yourself.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I was afraid to share them with anybody.
This origin story is a little fraught because
it was there.
Allie remembers us meeting, and I
at the Silvertone Tavern.
Don't.
Wow! Oh my god!
And it's possible it's because I was very drunk, but also it was you at least acknowledged that whatever the meeting was, it was really only for
it was in a group of people at the Bigitania show at the Silvertone Tavern.
But so we met for real a couple years later. I was friends with the ladies in the Bigitanias and kind of musical, you know, distance collaborators, and I remember Trish from the Bigitania is saying she had started jamming with this, I think she said you were 19, I don't even remember, 19-year-old amazing woman who had taught herself clarinet. And so that's how I heard about Allie. And then when Trish and Allie started collaborating in Poe Girl, we met. When Poe Girl was on their first American tour, I had moved to Chicago. And this was the end of 2003. And my band in Chicago was a band called JT in the Clouds. And we sort of threw together the first show for Poe Girl.
Our first show
in
the
Chicago.
US.
Yeah. And so it was really just a matter of like, from then on, it was, you, those bands were, you know, kind of brother sister bands. And, but I think in 2007, I went on the, we just found more and more excuses to do things together. Like in 2007, I went with Poe Girl to Europe for like 3 months and opened for them solo. And that was a whole comical period where Allie and I were, you know, things were sparking and we were together and we were like convinced
we were trying to be professional,
being successfully secretive, and then nobody,
so sweet. Else.
New, so there's lots of creeping between hotel rooms and just absurd stuff like that. But that's when it, you know, that's when it started. And but you know, through all that, it wasn't until the end of 2012 that like we really, you know, kind of carved out the space to do a project together that was focused on, you know, our dynamic. And and that's when Boys of Chicago started. And
the first record came out, self-titled Birds of Chicago came out, I think end of 2013, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we designed Birds of Chicago to be kind of a swirling collective.
Wait, not end of 2013, end of 2012, beginning of 2013. Because Ida was born at the end of 2013.
Yeah, you're right.
wait a minute, I'm confused.
it was always designed to be a collective or kind of a, with Allie and I as the fixed points. You know, we were the two that felt like it was normal to be on the road 250 days out of the year. But we had the sense to have a model where, you know, we started just the two of us being on the road, and then as time went on, we were able to bring in, you know, our people from our musical tribe and be on the road as a three piece, then be on the road as a four piece, and then just have some flexibility with that. And that was always the Birds of Chicago model. And we gave, you know, that's been what we've been doing for, you know, a good 7 years with that band. And it's grown into, you know, a really nice thing, a sort of a culture. But the aim was always to be able to use that as a sort of launching pad, to do other projects. And, you know, as I know you and Ali have talked about,
just like the Wu-Tang Clan,
just like, people get a little bit tired of the Birds of Chicago Wu-Tang comparison, but the reason why so many people make it is because it's, you know, it's the best one out there. The idea is to always be able to do, you know, collaborations with other people, solo records. And now, as I know you've heard about, Ali's solo record is like the first serious big launch, you know, from
exciting
of next year, I think.
Next year. Oh, I'm so excited.
So yet we'll find, we're sort of in the midst of the logistics right now. So there will be an announcement soon.
Oh, I can't wait. Everything you two do is magic. I'm so excited for all the projects and all the things.
Thank you so much. It means so much to us how deeply you listen, and just, you know, getting to have these conversations with you it's really special for us.
Oh, that's so touching. I feel the same way. It's, no, I'm just, I feel really, really lucky that you entered my life and just to be able to have these conversations means a whole lot. So thank you.
I love that the first time we talked was right after we just sat and cried listening to Mavis.
I know. Oh my goodness. That was so powerful, wasn't it?
Incredible. Yeah, it really was.
I feel so grateful that we were able to be there for that, you know?
Me too. I think about that all the time. And I feel grateful that whole conference somehow was able to happen in the teeth of COVID, you know, before we knew, you know, in the innocent time before.
The innocent time before we knew. Exactly. I was speaking with Mary Gaucher, who's at Folk Alliance as well. We were talking about just that, how amazing, crazy it is to think that we were all able to gather like that, you know, just before this pandemic hit, you know, and how, like, when will be the next time we can do that again, you know?
I got a text from a friend of ours in Toronto, a great songwriter who goes by the name O Susanna.
I love that.
She's amazing. You should check her out.
Oh, I will.
But she had been in Folk Alliance, and anyway, she texted us a few weeks back just to see how we were holding up. And it was the last, and when I got the text, I scrolled back, and the last time we had texted, we had been like in a frantic text session back and forth to try to figure out where we were going to have brunch in New Orleans around Folk Alliance.
Like,
and I was like, remember when this was the most serious shit that we had to sort out?
Totally. Oh my gosh.
Restaurant.
Where are we going to have lunch?
It feels like a world away. Yeah, it's so crazy. You know what I keep thinking about, though, is that, like, right now it feels so distant, and like it feels like it's unreachable, you know, in a way. But this is a weird analogy, but you know, when you're like feeling, when you're really, really sick, or when you're really, really down emotionally, and you just sort of feel like this is going to be the way it is forever, you know, and you're sort of like in that mentality, and like, but then it's not. Then like one day you wake up and you're better.
Just keep the past.
Exactly. Yeah. It'll happen. We don't know when, but it will. Yeah.
We're getting better at dealing with it, you know, and sadly, you know, there was not a coherent response to the pandemic in this country. There just wasn't
this country. Yeah.
So it was made more difficult here. And, but we are getting, I feel like we are getting better at navigating it, you know, and the fact,
totally,
the things that are so hopeful, how effective masks actually are, you know,
right.
That's right. Hopeful. The fact that I was just reading about, you were showing me the article about, there's this, you know, a home test for COVID that would give you results in 5 minutes. I think they're going to try and start disseminating around so that we can have really clear data and know right away
yeah.
if we're sick and stay home so that we don't spread it and don't, you know, and
yeah,
all those things. Like these are hopeful things, you know, and even the way we're being so resilient about, you know, how to navigate school.
Yes.
In Tennessee, our numbers have been terrible in Nashville. So the Nashville public schools made the right call not to go back into the classrooms. We're doing virtual school, but our school, which is a lovely community school called Explore Community School, it's a public charter here in Nashville. They encouraged families to form, you know, smaller, safe educational pods. And so we've done that with two other families. We have three girls in the first grade and the two younger siblings of the other two girls. And, you know, we've made our friends, Ben and Jamina, have turned their basement into a little schoolroom.
Oh my gosh. That's so beautiful.
They're on their Zoom class calls, but then they get to do social things together. And we three families are being very, very careful about COVID protocol. And we're kind of cyclically taking turns getting tested to make sure. One of the families, you know, has an elderly grandparent living in the home. So we have to be extra, extra careful. And it's, but it's what, you know, all of us adults wear masks, but the children get to run around and play together. And, you know, we're creating little pockets of goodness and community and taking
care. Oh, that's so great.
And I feel like, you know, knowing, being more, way more involved in our children's education is a really positive thing, you know, too.
Totally.
So there are these little silver linings, you know, that hopefully we're all starting to find and cultivate.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's so beautiful.
Garden. That was so exciting. You know, in our home, we've never been home long enough to grow a garden. So that's just been,
wow. That's wonderful. True. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Eating salad for the first time. Cause she grew it. It
was so amazing.
Without me having to like hide it in a smoothie or something.
That's amazing. Oh, cause so she felt like a sense of like pride, right? It's just like, I made this stuff.
Yeah, we really did.
Oh, that's such a good idea. That's really, really cool. Oh, that's beautiful. I just love the image of that, of the home, you know, kind of building this little pod in school and in the basement. That's so lovely.
It makes really all the difference just for her to feel like she's, well, literally she's getting up and, you know, taking her lunch box and going.
Yeah.
A different physical place, you know, not just staring at her parents.
right.
You know, it makes Zoom learning easier
for all of them, and they get to have breaks where they run around outside in our friend's backyard, and
that's great.
Really special.
Oh, that's great. It's good to hear. You know, I wanted to ask about, Ali, you mentioned earlier about you writing some poems and that, you know, you may or not share those. And I love the thought of, like, you know, that we have this, right, we can write for to share, we can write just for us, you know, for our own healing. And can you talk, maybe, you know, either or both of you, about that a little bit, about sort of just writing and like the healing powers of that, and like when you know it's something you want to share and when it's just for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me that's a kind of a blurred line. Sometimes I think I'm writing just for myself. And then I decide that it is something that should be shared. You know, when I started writing and co-writing my record with JT, and I worked really closely on it as well. When I started writing that, at first I kind of thought, well, this is just therapeutic. It's just for me. And then as we, you know, as I got into it more deeply and got feedback from JT as well, I realized that it was something I needed to share, you know, and a story I needed to tell, and that was part of my healing, was to break the silence in a very specific and intentional way. So that became, you know, something that I shared that I thought maybe would remain private. But I think a lot of us are so self-critical that we talk ourselves out of writing sometimes. And JT has been amazing for my process in that way, because he has much more of like what I would almost think of as like a Tin Pan Alley Brill Building ethic about his writing. You know, he just writes every day, no matter what.
Wow.
If he's feeling inspired, it doesn't matter if he's feeling miserable, he writes every day. And that kind of discipline, that dedication to craft and vocation has been really influential to me and really kind of life-changing of my process, where I think I used to wait for inspiration to strike a little too much, you know?
Yeah.
And now I make myself write as often, you know, I'm actually during this quarantine, I've been very disciplined. I've been writing every day. When I was on the road, I wasn't always as disciplined as he with keeping up with it daily. But since we've had this time, this for us unprecedented time home, I've been writing every day, and it's been really, really cathartic. And, you know, I'd say about maybe half of it, I'll probably eventually share.
Wow.
But I could be wrong about that.
No, that's so interesting, because I think it's like, you know, what you said about writing every day, it's like, I think sometimes we have to write the things that, like, kind of write and write the things that maybe are on the surface, and to get to the deeper things. Like, you know, it's like almost like you have to go through the process of that before you can actually get to what you, like, really want to say. If that makes any sense, you know?
No, it absolutely does. And your muscles will be strong and ready to take it down when you get there.
Because that's right. That's right.
Work it out. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. And I'm so fascinated. I love listening to people's writing process, because, you know, I don't write songs, but I write prose. And when I talk to people that are like in writing classes and things, and everyone has such different ways of writing. And like, for me, I do it sort of in bursts. Like, I'll just like sit down one day and I won't even know that I'm inspired to write, but I just start writing. And then it just like all these things flow out, and then I won't write for like 2 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm so curious, because I love hearing this, because I hear it from a lot of people that write daily, that sometimes it's like you sort of have to push yourself to do it. And yeah, then
absolutely.
You yeah. never know when the thing is going to come out that is like, oh, this is it, you know? Yeah.
And you could always try the experiment. Say, okay, for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to try and write one thing every day.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
It doesn't have to be, it could be haiku, you know, it doesn't have to be like.
Right. Right. You
know, it doesn't have to be a 30 volume tome.
Totally.
Yeah.
And what forms do you all both write in various forms, right? It's not like you don't just write songs, you write poetry. And Ali, you've been saying that you are working on potentially a memoir, which is so exciting.
Yes.
What is that? What's the process been between sort of the different styles of writing? Do you just sit down and say, okay, today I'm writing a poem, or do you just write what flows out?
I kind of just write what flows out. I have been trying to be more disciplined about writing something for the memoir every day. To keep it going, and just to not get bogged down, and when things feel too painful, like just to keep pushing through and processing and just getting stuff written down, you know, not editing myself before I have a chance to express myself.
Yes. Yes.
You know, editing is for later. So
that's right.
That's what I would say. I feel like I've fallen into that a lot in my life of self-editing, you know, before I have a chance to express. And so I'm being very disciplined about allowing myself to express, just get it written down, and then, you know, give it a little time before I go back and take the axe to it.
That's brilliant, because I think so many of us do that. It's like there's a story that you write and the story that you share, and they don't have to be the same thing,
exactly.
You know? So it's. I think you're right. We have to like let just be from the most honest, truthful place and share everything first to get it all out. And then you shape it. Then you come back and sort of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can't. Oh, my gosh. I can't wait to read your memoir.
Well, I'll keep working at it every day.
It's going to be incredible. I have no doubt. I'm sorry, JT, I didn't even ask you. What about you and your writing process?
Oh, no, I mean, not at all. I mean, it's similar. I mean, I think what you were talking about, I think the more you just write without a lot of precognition as to what you're going to be writing, the more I find it sorts itself out as to what it is and what it's supposed to be. You know, you're not spending as much mental energy kind of racking yourself about what it is or what it will be or what you should be writing.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, anytime as a, I think as a craftsperson or a writer, you can sort of feel like you're participating in a momentum that already exists, as opposed to sort of having to like generate your own self-start, your own power. That's a very, well, liberating and empowering thing. And I think for me, that happens the most when I'm writing a lot without a lot of worry about what it is going to eventually be. And I find that they tend to, when I'm doing that, they tend to find their own boxes and sort themselves out pretty reliably, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's such a key thing, just what you both said, you know, about just not doing the self-editing immediately, just getting it out.
yeah, for sure.
Getting it out first.
He, by the way, has written an entire record in the last couple months.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I mean, actually, I don't know what it is, but again, it's something, and it's got an identity, and again, it's that nice thing where you sort of begin to trust that what you're writing will tell you its name and tell you its. It's funny. I mean, it's just like, you know, with our kid, you know, I think when she was, oh, I don't know, 4.5 weeks old, we abandoned any notion of that parent, you know, parents like to have about that somehow we were going to get to shape and mold her personality. Like it was very,
right.
It was very clear that like it was all in there, and it was just a matter of time. It was just a matter of her waiting for the machinery to catch up with, so she could express it exactly the way she wanted. But like we knew we were just kind of hanging on for the ride. And, you know, and I think when you get into a really good flow, writing can feel that way too, where you're just sort of opening the door for these things to walk in, as opposed to like having to kind of like build your own Frankenstein every time.
Yeah, you're carrying on the slipstream when you get into that sweet spot.
Tears of rage, tears of grief, from Inglewood to Nairobi, we need a super love. Need a super lover, double dutch and hula hoops, all our fears in loops and loops. We need a super love, need a super lover. All the nights so cold, who among us dreams the dawn? Who could count the flowers in your heart? Oh, let me die before my child, pray every mother far away. That's a super love, I'm a super lover. You can feel it near and far. It fades the moon and blinds the super lover on the night so cold, who among us dreams the dawn? Who could count the flowers in your
You know, as artists, every single artist out there faces rejection in some form.
I've heard about that.
We've experienced that a fair bit. Yeah.
I mean, everybody has. Every single musician out there, even the ones that are you wouldn't even never know it, but everyone does. So I love asking, you know, if you could share a time in your musical life when something that you really wanted didn't work out. And then, but then something better came along in its place.
I'll let you choose, babe.
Well, that's a hard one. There's so many.
Well, you know what?
Lots of things. Well,
you should let me say this because you won't say your own thing. I will say that I am grateful. There's been a couple of stops along the way with Birds of Chicago, in the last few years where there was almost with kind of major label situations mm-hmm. that didn't happen. And I am at this moment personally grateful that they didn't happen because, and they were disappointing and frustrating at the time, but if they had happened, we wouldn't have had the temporal, spiritual, physical space for Allie to make this record that just got made. And like that, this record that she just made is what needs, what the world needs right now. So, I mean, there's a good example of just kind of, you know, of things being sort of the way things, you know, I really try not, I have a bit of a problem with people, you know, the kind of casual, like, oh, the universe, it's with the universe.
right.
Like, as if, you know, and all the sort of like, you know, logical, spiritual problems with believing that, you know, but I do think that there is a dynamic where if you trust that you are aligning yourself with good souls and in doing the work that you're supposed to be doing, that things will eventually align in the way that they need to align, you know, and that's,
it definitely feels
that way right now.
There's a large element of fortune in that too, right? A large element of just good luck and fortune.
Yeah, I think also just, you know, something that you both really exemplify, I think, is like, you know, the best things happen when you just sort of follow your curiosities, you know, and just sort of follow this instinctual thing and listen to that. And that's, it may not happen right away, but, you know, when things start to unfold, that they, the way that kind of align, you know, with like, right. And Allie, you and I have talked about this before about, like you were saying this, and I wholeheartedly agree that a lot of the sadness in the world, I think, of people and suffering from depression is just not being aligned with sort of the thing that they are really called to do, you know? Yeah. And I think what you've shown is that you really, you go towards those things that you, like, when you have like a spark of inspiration for something, you move towards it. And I think that's the way to do it. You know, it's not like you wake up one day and most people don't wake up and just say like, oh yes, I know exactly what I need to do to be, feel good and to like what I, you know, want to create. It's like, sometimes it takes a lot of like you sort of are picking up all these different rocks, like looking for the salamander, you know, like, where is it? But you know, if you keep kind of following and looking for it, you eventually usually find it, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes you discover that, you know, that cliched thing, but it's true. But sometimes you discover that the journey and the things you find along the way, or some of the rocks you pick up, are incredibly wonderful. You know,
totally
terrible. Both things can happen.
You
try to not get too discouraged by the incredibly terrible ones. You know, and keep the faith that inquiry is worth pursuing.
That's right, because that's information.
Allie said the thing about, you know, luck and fortune, and I guess to clarify what I mean is there's much that is swirling outside our control with fate but one thing that is within our control is to have some sense of what our energetic kind of soul imprint is in the world. And once you have that kind of consciousness, going out and aligning yourself with similar forces, and because that's tribe building, that's village building, that's coalition building, and
that is
where you create the kind of ripples, currents that that have the power to withstand like the kind of whims of, you know, disaster and fate, and, you know, those are the things that are built in disease, and those are the things that are built to sustain themselves through the worst sorts of disasters. And, you know, that's the stuff that we, you know, that we can control.
And that's true. And also there's a certain like back to the resilience muscle sort of thinking of like, I think it's easy to see people that are really doing well, let's say musically, and think like, oh, like it just happened for them. And it's just, it's never the case. You know, it's like the people that quote unquote succeed are the people that didn't get knocked down, but it's the ones who keep persevering over and over again, you know? That's how you get to that place, you know?
Right.
I think it's important for people to remember that. It's not just like, oh yeah. I mean, like you said, there is a lot of luck, but yeah, I don't know. I think everyone has a story when you hear, you know, even with you, Allie, you know, when we first sat down, I didn't know all the things that you had to go through, you know, before getting to where you are. You could have easily just been like, okay, forget it. I'm not going to do this because, you know, someone didn't want you to sing, you know,
but you did. Exactly. And I think that's, you're right. You know, it's the case for everybody. Everybody has gone through all types of forms of rejection and trauma and different things along their journey, right? No matter who you speak to, anyone who's particularly who's been called to a vocation that is as uncertain as art, you know, in various forms. It's not like that's, you know, there's a reason that parents want to push their kids into the STEM studies and away from art. It's because they're afraid of the uncertainty. And of course there's uncertainty within everything if we're honest, right? But I do understand that perception that it is even more uncertain if your calling is an artistic one. But the rewards are also so great, you know, and I'm not obviously talking about financial, although that can happen for some people, but just the deep, deep rewards of doing the thing that your spirit is crying out for, you know? Mm,
definitely. And you both mentioned sort of community and, you know, aligning with people that really sort of make your spirit soar and really feel like a good match for who you are, you know? And I think that's also such a deep part of feeling okay and right and feeling satisfied with what you're doing, because it's so easy to sort of have darker forces, you know, and have people in your life that you maybe aren't even fully recognizing that they're not aligned with your spirit, you know? And then, and that can be such a, I don't know. It makes all the difference.
Very, very draining.
Draining. Exactly.
Is what it ends up being, unfortunately, when it's just not the right combination, I think.
Yeah. And so how have you?
It doesn't serve anybody.
Silver lining of this whole quarantine, because I think that stuff kind of gets thrown in high relief in this period of enforced stillness and
much more conscious about who you let back in.
That's right.
Inner sanctum.
You know, people with those tendencies and people, you know, I mean, unfortunately, one of the downsides of this period is I think people that have had a lot of people, you know, some of their worst tendencies that they may when they're being fed in other ways in the course of their regular life, are when they're not being fed in this quarantine period, it allows some of their you know, their own personal kind of hobgoblins and demons to sort of take the wheel, you know, for a while. And I don't know why I'm saying some people. I mean, that's me too. That's everybody. And I think it's just, again, it's like one of those things. If you're just honest to that and open to the fact that struggle is going on all the time, and also maybe the optimistic side of it is you have a chance to be more aware of that struggle within yourself, and hopefully it gives you a chance to be a little more empathetic to that struggle and other folks. Mm-hmm. But it's real, you know? Yeah.
No, absolutely. That's such a good, that's so true. But yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the community aspect of what you've built, because you really do have you've built such a beautiful community around your family, you know, and you, like you said, chosen family. And I just think it's, you know, in order to get to that, you have to also be able to let people go, you know, or to not, cause it's, I don't know, it's something I've really learned over the years. It's like really important to sort of pay attention to the way your energy is around people? So like when you leave someone, do you feel more energized or do you feel drained? Yeah. You know, and that's sort of been my compass for how I try to, like, you know, have my own community and circles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like anything, you have to you have to sort of observe the wavelength over time, right? It can't.
Yeah, and tell me a little bit about. So you have, like, Ali, you have our native daughters, but I know you're both working on like other things too. Like, tell me, you have talked about this a bit, but sort of tell me what you're working on right now, because it seems that you're still very busy and keeping yourself busy with music and projects and stuff. So during this crazy time, what are you up to?
Well, we, you know, like all sort of working and working class musicians, had to figure out how to keep going during this time of no shows. So we actually finally got it together to make a Patreon. You know, we had never done that and we were nervous about it, but it's actually been really fun. So we started that, about a month ago?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so just doing little recordings and videos and things for that. We've been doing a few live stream things. We did, you know, we filmed something for the Philadelphia Folk Fest, and we're part of that. We've been sort of part of virtual festivals, the Calgary Folk Fest, things like that. I've been getting involved with Headcount. Layla and I, my sister, Layla McCalla from our Native Daughters, and I did something for Headcount. I've just been trying to do what I can. You know, I'm not a citizen here. I have a green card. I'm a permanent resident, but like I can't vote in this country. So one of the things that I've felt like that I can do to contribute is just try and encourage everyone who can vote to do so, you know?
So important right now, so more than ever.
to cast their votes that can. And so I've been kind of working on that a bit and working on, you know, preparing for my solo record release, which I'll be able to talk more about soon, publicly.
Yes,
but it's privately some very exciting things happening, and so I'm working on that and working on the book and working on being a better virtual homeschool mom. we have a bird feeder that I spend an inordinate amount of time watching the birds interact.
Oh, I love that.
these gopher, or not gophers, what are they called here? Woodchucks.
Woodchucks.
But it's the same thing we found out, gophers and woodchucks, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, really?
We have woodchucks that come around and also enjoy whatever the birds drop out of them.
That's so cute.
They've eaten half the garden, but we don't begrudge it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so we've just, you know, just trying to keep finding ways to work. And we've even done some, you know, JT's done some private kind of songwriting, workshopping with people and things.
That's great.
So yeah, we're just keeping busy in that way and sort of keeping the lights on and the water on and all of that.
Well, I love that you're doing so much, like what you described, there's so many things, but then you also are finding time to just watch the birds. I love that, you know, that's important.
It's thrilling. I've never had a bird feeder or a garden before. It's really restorative. Yeah.
My dad has been doing, you know, he keeps telling me about his bird feeder too. He gets so excited about the birds, and he'll be on the phone. Oh yeah. We'll be on the phone and he'll be like, oh my gosh, he'll tell me like what kind of bird is coming up and describe it. And it's really sweet.
Hey, real quick. Woodchucks and groundhogs.
Oh, it's groundhogs, not gophers. Sorry.
Gophers
are prairie similar. Dogs, right?
Gophers are similar.
And that's the same as a prairie dog.
Yeah, they're.
That's right.
Despite their similar appearances and burrowing habits, groundhogs and gophers don't have a whole lot in common. They don't even belong to the same family. For example, gophers belong to the family Geomyidae.
Geomyidae.
A group that includes pocket gophers. There'd be a good band name.
Yes.
Sometimes kangaroo rats and pocket mice. Groundhogs, meanwhile, I hope you're not going to edit any of this out. I hope, Monty.
Oh, no. Everyone needs to know this. This is staying in.
Scuridae, meaning Shadow Tail. That is really
cool. Belonging to the genus Marmota.
Marmots.
All right.
All right. Well, this is
awesome. I love it.
We have groundhog / woodchucks that we have a family of them. So there's Sam Elliott, the dad, Lilac, the mom. And then there have been 2 to 3 babies. We're not sure how many.
Oh my gosh.
And they have been the ones that are hanging out at the bird feeder the most.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Do you have a dog or cat or anything?
No, but Ida has been lobbying really hard for a dog. And we may try to, because we now have this, you know, we always thought we couldn't.
Oh, because of the road.
Because you're on the road. But now, you know, it's not like everything that we're reading, you know, it's very unlikely that there'll be any kind of significant touring happening again before, you know, the fall or the end of next year, I suspect. So, if not longer, you know, so we are considering fostering a dog.
That's a great idea.
A home for a little while. And then hopefully we can use an agency maybe that allows you to adopt if
right
dog feels like the right fit for your family. But in the meantime,
oh, that would be beautiful. And
see how I all the responsibility and stuff like that. So
that's a good way to kind of test the waters, you know, and see. I always want to foster, but I'm worried that I would end up with like 30 dogs and like 20 cats if I did that.
That may happen to us. Check back in a year. We might have 25.
Yes. Yeah. Have you seen the Dodo video? I think it was called Dodo. Dobo or Dodo. I don't remember the little, have you heard of this?
No, we don't.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I'm going to send it to you after this. Okay. It's an Instagram account. And then they also have these like videos on a website too. And they're all these really, really cute animal videos. And like a lot of times it's like fostering or like, you know, animals that were really sick or ill and then they become like totally healed. And I mean, I just spend so much time watching those things and I just start sobbing and it's like the whole thing. It's good.
I got really interested in this subgroup of like giant animals being rescued from like mud bogs and things like that by groups. I recommend that. Some, you know, baby elephants stuck in a mud. Whole village gets together to get them out. Whales.
It's so beautiful. It's just so heartwarming, you know? And
no, we're looking for ways to feel good about humans.
No. Yes. Yes, exactly. Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I have one more question for you because I feel like we could talk all day. So I'm going to like give you your day back, but I want to ask you one more question. Can you think of one fan? I'm sure there's many, but like a fan interaction, you know, and it could be either you as fans or other way around of fans of yours, like that just had some kind of a big impact on you.
Yeah. Well, I would say we met an absolutely amazing woman named Ashley who, we met her at, it was the Audubon, an event that the Green River Festival was putting on to support the Audubon Society in Northampton. And we played the show and Ashley came up to us afterward and we just got into this deep discussion with her. And she has since become, you know, a friend, I would say. And we're going to be doing a special panel with her for, is it Yale University? Mm-hmm. Coming up soon, we'll be making announcements about it. But she's just a really, really.
Well, the first thing he showed us is that our music had helped her through a very serious illness.
And
I don't know. We've heard various, you know, that has happened over time, and that's always just like one of the most sustaining things you could ever hear. But there was something about like the direct and just frank way that she told us that day that was, I don't know, it was really, you know, sometimes just things just get in farther than other times. And really felt it that day, and also she's just a powerful spirit. So
she
it was clear that
very healing work in the world. She's part of a study of, you know, what happens for underprivileged single moms. Something as simple as diapers being delivered every month can change outcomes for families, you know. And so she's part of these this study at Yale, looking into ways to support underserved communities and families that can be life-changing and yet so simple.
You know? Wow.
I guess that's probably why it was powerful, is because you realize very quickly, well, like, here's an amazing person doing amazing work in the world. And if our music was even like the smallest part of helping us not lose her so she could keep doing amazing work in the world,
that's part of that,
you know, the thing we were talking about earlier, the you found your tribes.
Yeah. Yeah. Goodness. I also, one of my dear friends used to always say to me, like, goodness recognizes goodness, you know, and that makes me think of that when you just describe that. It's such a beautiful story. I got chills all over. Thank you for sharing it. And thank you too for being such lights in this world. And truly, I was like, when I woke up this morning, I was feeling, you know, a little sad, and I feel so much better right now just after speaking with you. So thank you.
Hey, it's such a, it's just, you're easy to talk to.
Yeah, this was really good for my heart. So thank you both. And I really can't wait till the day we can see each other in person again, you know, that'll be so lovely.
It will come.
Yes.
We are getting through this, you know.
Yes. Well, big hugs to both of you, and stay well until the next time we get to talk.
Thank you, and you too. It was so lovely hearing your voice.
Yeah. Likewise.
Yeah.
Bye.